Thanks so much. Happy to be able to introduce myself like this. Thank you for putting up with this very weak title. There's sort of two halves of my research that don't really communicate at all with each other, other than they both vaguely involve computers. So this is where we're gonna go. I'm gonna start off with the purple half of the talk, which is gonna be about my work on GRB afterglows and electromagnetic counterparts to gravitational wave sources. And then the second half of my talk, the orange bit, is going to be about accretion onto binary black holes. And I'm just gonna jump right in there. If I can remember, there we go. Okay, so GRB afterglows. For any of you, I gave a similar talk here last fall, so this might be a little bit familiar. To those of you who saw it, but in which case the second half will be brand new. And if you haven't, and if you weren't here last fall, then this is all new. So here we go. This is the night sky, unless Elon Musk gets his way. And it looks very, very nice, very familiar. We see the Milky Way and all the stars and large and small Magellanic clouds. But of course, there's more wavelengths than we can look at. This is just sort of the optical sky. The gamma ray sky looks more like this. This is an image from Fermi, just sort of their all sky map. And it's very cool. All these point sources, distant and near, sort of AGN and things, bunch of diffuse emission from the galaxy. And if you stare out at the gamma ray sky, every once in a while, here's the same image, sort of much coarser grained. And if you just stare and look out at the gamma ray sky, every once in a while, something like this happens. There will be a bright flash, washes out the entire sky, brighter than the entire sky put together for a few seconds. And these things are called gamma ray bursts. Gamma ray bursts are bright explosions. They're the most luminous explosions in the galaxy. Or in the universe, they roughly occur daily, although we don't detect all of them, but we detect sort of on the order of 100 or more per year. They can last less than a second or up to several minutes. They occur at cosmological distances. We know this for a while now. And roughly speaking, they occur in two types. Long bursts last for longer than 2 seconds and originate from the collapse of massive stars. And short bursts last for less than 2 seconds. And we now know that they can come from the merger of two neutron stars. And the detailed physics, what actually produces the detailed mechanism that produces the gamma rays themselves, we still don't know. We know it involves ultra-relativistic jets and these sort of violent events, but the actual details as to how these things actually end up producing all these gamma rays is still unknown, although there are, of course, many ideas. After every GRB, if you have a good enough telescope, there will be an afterglow. Afterglows are broadband, so the gamma ray burst itself is sort of only visible in gamma rays and sort of hard X-rays sometimes. The afterglow is sort of a broadband electromagnetic signal. You can see it in radio, optical, X-ray, gamma rays, and even now very high energy TeV emission has been seen from these things. It's synchrotron emission. It lasts for days, weeks, months, years sometimes after the original burst. And afterglows are very, very useful. Because they last for so long and are seen in so many wavelengths, we can follow them up with many instruments. It allows us to identify host galaxies on the sky because we have very good angular resolution with optical instruments, for instance. And they have been a very, very handy tool for the last, 20 odd years of GRB science.
So Geoffrey, I have a quick question. So what decides the time scale as to how long an afterglow lasts? Like you said, it could be from weeks to years.
So the afterglow itself lasts for years or even longer. It's sort of an explosion in a distant galaxy. It drives a shockwave. We're going to talk about all of this. But really eventually just fades from view. So the ones that are sort of close by are very bright. We can see for much longer. The ones that are far away and fainter, they fade away, and then we just can't detect them anymore.
I see. So it's more like a distance thing than like they just fade away and we can't see it. Like there's no other characteristic mechanism which decides its length.
Not to my knowledge, at least. Eventually, you're going to get things like if this thing was in like a wind medium, it might run into the local ISM, and that might change how things work a little bit. But in principle, these things sort of will evolve to be something like supernova remnants, which in the galaxy we can see for hundreds of years after the original supernova.
Okay, thanks.
The anatomy of a gamma ray burst, sort of from start to finish, goes something like this. There's a progenitor, a system, either one of these massive collapsing stars or a binary neutron star system. The massive star collapses, the binary neutron stars merge, and they produce a central engine. The central engine is either a magnetar or a black hole, or maybe sometimes it's one or the other. We don't really know. There's good arguments to be made both ways at this point. Somehow the central engine, either the magnetar or the black hole, produces an ultra-relativistic jet. This jet breaks out of the surrounding material, sort of the stellar envelope or the neutron star merger ejecta. This ultra-relativistic jet somehow produces a whole bunch of gamma rays that we see as the GRB itself. This is called the prompt emission. The ejecta expands, the jet expands at very close to the speed of light, and eventually starts producing afterglow emission. The material behind it will then produce either kilonova or supernova emission, depending on whether it was a massive star or a binary neutron star merger. Then all of these photons need to travel through the galaxy that they're in. They get extincted, they travel through they travel between the galaxies, they hit the Milky Way, they get extincted again, and then finally they're observed by a telescope, either on Earth or in orbit. This is a little picture of SWIFT, which is my favorite telescope. It is quite excellent, especially for GRBs, but all sorts of transient things. There are a couple big open questions in GRB science. The first one is sort of, what is the central engine? There are cases for it to be magnetar, cases to be made for it to be a black hole. This is something that ultimately a lot of us would like to answer. Also, how does this jet get produced in detail? You know, what is the mechanism that can produce this jet, and how does it make all of these gamma rays? These would also be nice things to know. A lot of people here at Perimeter have a lot of experience with this question, and sort of approach it from sort of first principles from the beginning. Of course the proper thing to do is to take one of these systems and simulate it, really high resolution, really good code, and then see what you can see if you can produce one of these jets and see what the things look like. This is still just a little bit of beyond our ability. But there's a lot of people who are working on this. You need GRMHD and possibly video transfer and all sorts of things. It's a very promising avenue. My avenue for this is to actually come at it from the other way, I focus on the afterglow, this part here, which is sort of the part that we understand the emission mechanism the best. And I would like to understand the afterglow in as much detail as possible, fit it to data, and sort of see what the data can tell us sort of about the afterglow and the things that produced it, hopefully. Schematic, this is sort of the process of how you produce an afterglow. On the left-hand side here, we have our central engine. It produces a jet, it has a lot of energy. This jet sort of gives the burst. And then eventually this jet starts interacting with the surrounding media, just the interstellar gas around the central engine. It drives a shockwave through this material, and this shockwave will produce synchrotron emission. So we have our jet right at the beginning there. It makes this blast wave, which sort of just rips through the local gas, and then that emits synchrotron emission, which we can see from Earth. This is a simulation that a colleague of mine did. just to show you what one of these blast waves might look like. So it starts off with a Lorentz factor of about 500. This is not sort of a first principle simulation, of course. This is sort of just simulating one of these ultra-relativistic shock waves. And we're in a moving frame that's going to move along with the front of the burst. On the left-hand side here, we just see the energy density. We see these shocks are very, very thin. They're sort of Lorentz compressed because they're moving at these ultra-relativistic velocities. And they just sort of decelerate for a really long time until eventually they decelerate enough that causal contact is made across the jet surface, at which point the jet can start to spread and it becomes more of a spherical shape eventually. So there we go. It falls off the back because our frame is moving faster than the jet at the very end there. So what does the emission from one of these shockwaves actually look like? We can figure this out pretty simply. On the left-hand side here, there's sort of a pale circle, which is just showing you sort of the face of a jet. Imagine we're staring right down at it. And it has a very high Lorentz factor, about 30. The gray circle is showing you the beaming cone. This is the area of the jet that an observer in front of the jet could actually see. We're sort of situated right down the jet axis. Because the jet is moving ultra-relativistically, most of the light from each little patch of the jet is beamed in a very tight cone directly in front of it. So only the stuff along the jet axis in the circle is stuff that we can see. On the right-hand side, we're going to see a light curve, just the emission as a function of time. So at first, the jet decelerates, and it gets dimmer, and we see sort of this bright emission that dims with time. This dimming is somewhat compensated by the fact that as it decelerates, these beaming cones open up, and we can see more and more of the jet. So we see more and more surface. Eventually, there's no more surface to see, and the whole thing continues to decelerate. And we see this break in the light curve that we call the jet break. And the jet break is a very important feature. It sort of is very intrinsically related to the geometry of these surfaces and can teach us about the geometry of these jets. And we've known sort of the basic principles of this for a very long time. And we have sort of, there's analytic, we know how synchrotron radiation works. And so we have analytic predictions for what the slope of sort of both of these segments should be pre and post jet break. And the time of this jet break scales with the size of the jet, the opening angle to the 8/3.
Jeff, yeah. You have a parameter P there. What is that parameter?
That parameter P is the power law index for the energy distribution for the non-thermal electrons. So the non-thermal electrons, we'll get into this, I think, on the next slide. But at the shock front, you accelerate a population of non-thermal electrons, and they have a distribution in Lorentz factor. That goes like Lorentz factor to the minus p. So depending on sort of the steepness of this distribution, you'll get sort of slightly different spectra, say synchrotron spectra, and that will affect how light curve evolves a little bit.
All right, thank you.
And so indeed, this is what we're going to do right here. So we can lay down some actual parameters now. The jet, we normally talk about having a total isotropic equivalent energy, E0, and an opening angle, we can call it theta C for the core. It expands into a local medium, density N. And at the shock front, we spin up, sort of turbulence at the shock front will spin up a magnetic field. And we don't know how strong the magnetic field will be. You can do this with pick simulations, but it's quite difficult. And so we normally parameterize our ignorance. We give it a parameter epsilon B that tells us sort of the fraction of thermal energy that will, the equipartition fraction that will go into the magnetic field. Similar, this is epsilon E parameter we talk about a lot that tells us how much energy is going to go into the non-thermal electrons that get accelerated by bouncing across the shock front. And P tells us the slope of this energy distribution. And these are sort of microphysical parameters that will determine the details of the synchrotron radiation. And then we have the Earth. The Earth doesn't have to be staring right down the jet axis. It can be some viewing angle theta V away. So what happens if your viewer is a little bit just off the center of the jet? It starts off very similarly. our beaming cone opens up, and the jet decelerates, except you see the one side of the jet before you see the other side of the jet. This tends to prolong the jet break. And leaves us with a, there we go. This tends to prolong the jet break, and the amount by which it prolongs, because we'll see the first side of the jet at sort of the core angle minus the viewing angle, and then we'll see the other side at the opening angle plus the viewing angle. But both of these things, again, they scale with angles to the 1/3 power and the same slopes as before. We have very good analytic control over this sort of segment as well, although this intermediary slope gets a little tricky. And I should say, we care about viewing angles here because, it's very unlikely that we're staring directly down the edge of any one of these jets. These jets have some sort of solid angle, and if they're distributed isotropically in the sky, chances are you're closer to the edge than the center. Moreover, we care, of course, about gravitational wave counterparts, and gravitational wave and LIGO will detect these neutron stars at all sorts of inclinations. And so we really care how these things look like when the jet isn't pointed directly at us. This is very important for understanding gravitational wave sources. And now this is what happens if we're really far off axis. If the viewing angle, we're sort of staring, we aren't even in the beaming cone initially, we get no initial emission until one side of it comes into view, quickly the other side comes out of view. And then we'll see some sort of very steep rising slope, the same final slope, and the width of this is again controlled by the viewing angle and the opening angle. This scenario is called an orphan afterglow, and this was sort of what everyone expected. The afterglows, not everyone, this is what I think many people, the sort of general wisdom that afterglows from a LIGO source, for instance, would look something like this. The jet would be pointed directly away from us, we wouldn't see anything at first, it would peak, and then drop off, and we might be able to learn something about the opening angle and viewing angle from the width or the timing of this peak. But it's important to remember something, and the thing to remember is that all of these models I'm talking about so far are these very simple jet models that are sort of have uniform energy and Lorentz factor across their surface. And that is not necessarily the best description of reality. So the famous 17817 happened, of course, a few years ago. We saw gravitational waves from it. We saw a gamma ray burst, first electromagnetic counterpart from gravitational wave source. We saw kilonova emission, which was very exciting. First kilonova ever sort of unambiguously detected. And we saw afterglow emission, which was unexpected. Well, both the gamma ray burst and afterglow were unexpected. We sort of were assuming that we're going to be in this orphan afterglow scenario. We'd have to be very lucky to see one of these things, but we saw it on the first try. And we expected to see one of these steep rises with a bump at late times, but instead we saw this. So this is the real observational data. This is the afterglow of 17817, and it does not look like any of the light curves I just showed you. We saw it in sort of more or less three bands. We have radio, optical, and X-ray observations. And everything is consistent with sort of a slow power law rise over sort of a couple hundred days. It sort of peaks at late times and does some sort of decay. And this was very unexpected. And we have the parameters, et cetera, and many people have looked at this and followed this up with all sorts of models. And the thing to remember is that no jet in the universe is one of these top hat jets. Nature abhors a step function. Any sort of real physical system is going to have some sort of gradient in sort of the energy and Lorentz factor of jet that it produces. It might be brighter in the center, it might be brighter at the edges, but there's going to be some sort of profile to it that may be steep, it may be shallow, but it's not going to be one of these step functions. And so people have done simulations of these, of course, for many, many years, and they find sort of all sorts of curves. Some of them have these long power law wings, some of them are sort of more peaked, but none of them are top hats. And so we often talk about, and so we parameterize these jets by sort of their isotropic equivalent energy as a function of angle going down the jet. And most of the ones people see are sort of have most energy at the core, and then sort of some decreasing profile as the angle gets larger. So what happens if you take one of these structured jets and produce an afterglow from it? Well, it looks something like this. These are three different structure models, so three different possible profiles for the jets, just sort of a simple Gaussian and then a power law with sort of a long tail. And blue is sort of your simple top hat. And if you're on axis, all of these things look exactly the same. You have sort of a bright decrease, and then sort of eventually sort of opens up, and you get very similar late time behavior as well. As you go more and more off axis, you can see the differences between both these models in the top hat and between these two different models themselves.
Jeff?
Yeah.
Can I ask you, so I mean, to some degree for an outsider that pays attention to this, there is a bit of semantics, right? Because why can I not take a top hat, give it some structure, and then make it look like, I mean, there has to be some freedom in the top hat. The top hat cannot be, what I'm trying to say is that cannot be so rigid as to not have enough parameters that it can modify it. And of course, at some point it might look exactly like what others are calling structure jet. I mean, isn't there a bit of semantics here?
Oh, so the language is that sort of a top hat jet means a jet that is just has a step function energy profile. It has constant energy, truncates zero. That's what we mean by a top hat. So if there is some sort of profile, if there's more parameters, then that's sort of generally what we call a structured jet, a jet that has sort of non-trivial structure. Top hat just means the trivial case.
Right. So in some sense, can I think of the top hat just as one extreme of the structure jet?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And the top hat is sort of the GRB community's like spherical cow. Everyone sort of assumed it for a very long time because it was very easy to work with analytically, and there wasn't really a lot of data that needed anything better. It's worked very well for a very long time. And 17817 was sort of the big sort of kick we all needed to really take sort of structure and viewing angle a lot more seriously.
Thank you.
So how can one of these, so these light curves here look a lot different than the light curves I was showing you before. And so how do we get this? How do we get, why do these look different than a top hat? And so we'll show this video for one last time. Here we have, now we have a sort of a Gaussian jet with a gradient of energy along its surface and a viewer who is viewing it from some angle. And the viewer's patch has a gradient of energy along it. And the brightest material is the stuff will be the most energetic material closest to the jet center. As the jet decelerates, the brightest material moves inwards. And you see brighter and brighter material with time until you can see the whole jet and you get a normal decay. This is starting to get complicated now. We don't know exactly what the slope of this should be. We suspect probably at the end of this, when it's become non-relativistic, it should decay with a similar slope to what it did before. But you know, how do we figure out what this increasing slope is? And it turns out it's not too bad. What you can do is you can take your structured jet and pretend every annulus of it is just a little top hat. And each of these sort of, you know, truncated top hat jets are going to have their own light curves. They're going each going to be like one of these sort of orphan afterglows. That sort of peaks really, that raises really steeply, peaks and then decays. And then what we see in time is just sort of riding along the surface of all of these peaks as we get closer and closer to the center. And we have analytic control over these individual segments, so we can figure out analytically what the slope of the whole should be. And we're able to figure out this formula for it. So we have to add in this new parameter G, which sort of depends on the viewing angle and also the gradient of energy at the particular point you are in the jet. And for a Gaussian structure, it sort of reduces to this very simple formula that the slope depends on the ratio of the viewing angle to the opening angle of the jet. For different structure models, this last formula will be different. So for a power law structure or some sort of double exponential or some numerical thing from a simulation, this first formula holds true, but the second equality will change. And we can take this and apply it to 17817. We know what the rising slope was. It was about 0.9. That tells us this G parameter should have been about 8.2. And so immediately we can read off without having to do any simulations that we should be about six, viewing this thing at about six times the opening angle, assuming it's one of these Gaussian jets. That's if it was a different structure, the detailed relationship would be different. So that's exciting, but of course we'd like to do, and then we can glue this all together now. If we're on the left-hand side, you know, this is what a standard afterglow looks like. If we're staring right down the barrel of the jet, we have sort of a slow decay and then a fast decay separated by this jet break. For a structured jet, if you're sort of in the wings of the jet a little bit, you might initially see something that looks like a standard afterglow, until the beaming cone opens up enough that you can see more of the jet. You see there's a gradient there, and then you get one of these structured phases, that's the middle panel, and then eventually it decays like a regular jet, like a regular afterglow. And if you're really far off axis, then you might see something like the orphan scenario, where you have the steep rise, structured phase, and then a decay. So now we want to take all this and throw this at 17817. We want to do a little bit better than just this analytic thing, and this is really where the computers come in handy. So we can code up our model, which is a little bit more sophisticated than just this analytic thing. We can actually sort of simulate all of these afterglow, all each segment of this jet. Compute its afterglow emission, take into account all of the relativistic corrections, integrate over the observed surface, and produce light curves. And then we can fit those light curves and run it millions of times, use MCMC, and do parameter estimation against the actual data. So this is from a paper from a couple years ago. It's not the full data set. This is probably the last time that the result was very clean. And so it's very easy to fit this thing with one of these structured jet models, which really all jets should be structured jets. And we get a very nice situation, an opening angle of about 3 degrees, viewing it at about 20 degrees, a bit more than 20 degrees, and about 10 to the 50 ergs of kinetic energy is required to make this thing. And of course, we're doing full MCMC parameter estimation, so we get a big corner plot and all the correlations. And there's a lot of degeneracies between these parameters. There's a lot of just sort of power laws underlying these things that we only sort of have one constraint on. And if you just fit the afterglow alone with sort of generic priors on all your parameters, then you get something, then you get a viewing angle of about 30 degrees and sort of a bit of a larger opening angle. But LIGO also gives us an independent constraint on the viewing angle. And so if you use their posteriors as a prior, you can actually, we can sort of fix up our fit a little bit, use both data sets, and we get a sort of a more, sort of our a final result of this sort of 20 degrees and the opening angle shrinks a little bit. So sort of using all the available data is really handy in these situations. And now, of course,
sorry if I could just interrupt. I was just curious because it seemed like before you add the LIGO prior, the viewing angle was like 30 degrees, which was very close to the mean value for LIGO. But then when you added the prior, it seemed to shift. Did I see that right?
Yeah, the LIGO prior isn't a Gaussian.
I see.
Or so it's not sort of evenly centered. It's sort of more like a Gaussian in the cosine of the angle. And so when you sort of plug everything through, it ends up shrinking what the EM angle should be.
I see. So it actually disfavors that 30 degrees.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. And of course, what I'd like to tell you now is that now we can identify what the structure is. We have all this data. We can say, aha, yes, it was a Gaussian jet, or oh, it was a power law jet with some tail. Unfortunately, this is very difficult to do. This is sort of the constraints we get on the structure the energy as a function of angle throughout the jet. And I've blocked this off depending on what viewing angle we assume. So if we take a viewing angle in sort of the first 25% of what our fit does, fit allows for, then we get this sort of pink block. And if we have in the last 25%, we get the blue block and also everything in between. And we can see here the on-axis energy is sort of constrained by, you know, to three orders of magnitude or something. And there's a huge range of profiles that could fit in these blocks. And there's and then this is because there's this sort of strong degeneracy between the details of the structure and the viewing angle. It's impossible. It's without knowing one of them already, it's very hard to say what the other one is going to be. We sort of only really get this particular combination in this G parameter. So this is unfortunate. It'll be very difficult to identify the structure of any one individual burst from the afterglow alone. It may be possible to do it with a population, though, if we can see many of these things and start measuring this G parameter that controls this sort of rising slope. This G parameter traces out a very particular curve as a function of viewing angle for different bursts. And so if we start to rack up a lot of measurements of this G parameter, you know, over many, many years, of course, we might be able to start narrowing down or constraining what some of these models may look like from the data side. And this is absent any other data. This is just from the afterglow alone. The other computer side of this thing is, this model I hope will be very useful for these afterglows. And so it's been written up and published in this package AfterglowPy, which is, it's the first public and open source model for computing these afterglows. It's all in Python 3. You can install it with pip. There's some documentation that's slowly growing on read the docs, and it produces, it sort of does this whole procedure. It simulates sort of each segment of this shockwave with sort of a simple shock jump condition type of evolution. It does the forward shock synchrotron emission, and a couple of details in the model have been calibrated to this simulation-based tool called BoxFit. And you can do several of these jet structures, top hats, Gaussians, these power law jets with the long tails, any viewing angle you want. The public version has constant surrounding densities, and wind densities are going to be available hopefully like this month. I've finished it, just sort of need to push the update. And this has been great. Many groups have started to, I've used this a lot now, and many other groups have you used it as well, incorporated into their fits and things. So this has been lovely. So a couple other applications of this. There's a few of these that I talked about last year. We've used this to help identify potential kilonova candidates in the archive, sort of with a better GRB afterglow model. We can now go back and sort of subtract afterglow emission and try to look for outstanding kilonova emission. But I actually want to talk about a couple applications to long GRBs. So this is sort of the first evidence for jet structure in a long GRB. This is 16625B. This is a project with Ginny Cunningham, who was a grad student at UMD and just recently started at Space Telescope as a postdoc. And she assembled a great data set for 16625B, as well as many other GRBs that we're still working on. And this one, we were able to hit this with sort of our structured jet models, as well as models for other, as well as the top hat model, and we buried everything, and in the end, the structured jet model was preferred at 3 sigma, and we got sort of non-zero viewing angles, which sort of traditionally these things were always fit these sort of on-axis top hats, and so this one provided really good evidence that there's actually more in these things than just the simple models. This was sort of the first unambiguous detection of structure in one of these guys.
Jeff, just out of curiosity, do we know the distance to this GRB? That would be interesting if we have actually a non-zero opening angle. So if we're looking like with some non-zero observer angle, it would actually be interesting to see like how far that is.
Yeah, we do. I do not remember what it is, but we do have a redshift in a host galaxy for it. Okay, so good. We know that the distance. And this is sort of a recent paper that just came out in Nature Astronomy, sort of the shortest long GRB. So long GRBs are typically any GRB that lasts longer than 2 seconds. That's sort of the cutoff we say. This was a GRB that lasted for 2/3 of a second, which is quite a bit shorter than two. So it was initially classified as a short GRB, except when you look at it, except there was an excess of optical and IR emission at late times, which is sort of consistent with a supernova. And supernova are what you expect from long GRBs, not short GRBs. And so we were able to hit this with our afterglow models. We added in, we accounted for host extinction and these sorts of things, because adding in dust can really mess up sort of your relative fluxes in different optical and IR bands. And it seems very, 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 very clearly in the end, even with sort of allowing for potentially one of these sort of plateaus or rising phases from jet structure, the best fit for the afterglow is really just sort of a straight decrease, regular afterglow. And this last little yellow point here is, you know, many times greater than the afterglow model and is best explained by just a supernova. So even though this thing came in with a time associated with a short GRB, like a binary neutron star merger, this thing almost certainly came from a collapsing massive star. So it's a very short long GRB. And finally, back to 17817. I've spent way too much time staring at this thing, and now you guys can too. There's more data than just the sort of raw afterglow light curves and the gravitational waves. People also, initially, sort of every telescope that people could get were looking at this thing, and some groups were able to take VLBI radio measurements that constrained the position of the GRB on the sky, at least of the radio centroid. And then they looked again 100 odd days later, and it had moved unambiguously. And so that's what you see on the right-hand side here. These black data points are the three VLBI epochs we have. And the GRB sort of moved eastwards. I'm not great at the sky stuff, but it moved eastwards across the sky unambiguously. And if you have a relativistic light source moving sort of at an angle to you across the sky, it can display apparent superluminal motion, which this indeed did. This was moving, this appears to be moving at about 4 times the speed of light. Of course it isn't, this is a relativistic effect that's well known, but you can use this to actually additionally constrain the viewing angle. And which is sort of a nice independent constraint that we can add on top of everything else. And there's been an additional hiccup recently in studying this thing, where if you look down here, the purple points are our X-ray observations. We can still see this thing in the X-rays 3.5 years after it went off. And the X-ray data are all a little bit above the model. And there's one point that's incredibly above the model. And there's been a lot of debate as to this, as to whether or not there is a new source showing up at late times. People have talked about that the kilonova material could be producing its own afterglow. The central engine could be having some late time activity. A lot of there's a lot of sort of ideas, and people are talking a lot about this. But it's hard to say, because we're really sort of near the edge of the data and what we can detect. So we really have to use sort of every photon that we can to try to determine whether or not there's a real new source here.
Jeff, two questions. So you said you can restrict or you constrain the viewing angle by this kind of apparent superluminal motion, but that also requires you to have some knowledge of what its intrinsic velocity is as well, right? So there is an assumption there. And then let me just ask this, the second one at the same time. In the left plot, yes, there is an excess in the early part that one can clearly see in the 6 and 1.2, 10 to whatever, frequent hertz, but nothing in the blue?
No, so the blue is all, I should have explained this. The green is all radio emission. That's 10 to the 9, so that's like gigahertz. And the gigahertz and the radio emission is sort of all over the place, but we can, but sort of there's an equal number of points above and below, and everything works out. The blue is all optical IR detections, mostly from Hubble. And at this point, the afterglow has faded from view. And so we can't, everything looks sort of, and so we can constrain this as best we can with the Hubble observations, but we're probably not going to get any more from there. It's just sort of being swamped by the light of the host galaxy. And then the purple is all X-ray. And these are all Chandra observations. And it's the X-rays that have been brighter than expected recently. And for the velocity question, yes, absolutely. Luckily, our afterglow model, we simulate the evolution of the entire blast wave. So we know sort of the time-dependent Lorentz factor of each segment of this blast wave. So we can actually compute where sort of on the sky the centroid of the emission should be. And that's what we've done here on the right-hand side. This is the blue circles are the model predictions for where each of these data points should be. And sort of the hazy cloud on the right is the origin point. So we did it. So I did a fit with this most recent data set, including all these centroid constraints, allowing sort of the origin point to change and the direction of the position angle, the GRB to change. And these are sort of the results we can get out when we try to fit this all with the GRB alone.
So thank you. But that brings me another question. So you said you have a model of the velocities of this blast wave. Mm-hmm. But is that a model or is that an observation? Because then if it is a model, then I keep going backwards. And so eventually we get all the way to the engine and say, okay, this is how there is an unknown at the end of that sequence, right?
Right. Yeah. So this is a model and we're fitting for all the parameters. We're fitting for the initial energy and the opening angle. And these things will determine the Lorentz factor profile and how the Lorentz factor evolves as a function of time. This is not directly tied to the engine Lorentz factor. All of these observations are happening well after the jet has started to sweep up ISM and is now decelerating.
Hi, thank you.
And so we can take this and we can add in, one thing we can do is we can add in an extra X-ray component and see how that changes things. And we can just say, well, what if there's something other source, some arbitrary source providing X-rays? And what this does is this allows us to sort of nicely sail through all the X-ray observations, of course, but it also gives us better agreement with the radio data. So here, you know, we're really sort of pushing the jet model, what it can do. It's trying to increase X-ray emission to get these last data points. To do that, it needs a wider jet with more surface area and more emission. And then it also needs to be more off axis. But as you get more off axis, that shrinks the motion across the sky. But we know how big the motion across the sky is. That sort of there's a lot of tension between these things. And if you relieve that tension by allowing there to be an extra X-ray component, you just fit everything a whole lot better at the cost of a new parameter and potentially a new source. Yeah, whether or not that's a cost or not is up to what your model is. But unfortunately, this improvement is only about 2 sigma, as best we can determine. So we don't have any sort of robust evidence for a new source yet. But observations of this are going to continue. And so hopefully we'll know more in the future.
Sorry, Jeff, am I supposed to see the improvement by eye? I mean, I saw a little bit of a difference, but...
Yeah, it's hard to see by eye. It's most obvious if the purple light curve now goes right through the data points at the very end there. But of course, that's obvious because we're just adding a new thing that can go through the data points. The fit on the right also gets a little bit better, but it's hard to tell unless you've been staring at this for months.
Oh, but then I'm staring at the wrong place in the plot. I'm not looking at the right of the left plot, but I'm looking more. My eyes want to go to the left of the left plot.
Ah, the left of the left of the left plot doesn't really matter. Everything's upper limits over there.
Oh, okay, thank you.
So, sorry, can I drill on this a little more?
Yeah, go ahead.
Because since you mentioned all sort of the controversy about this, you know, potential rebrightening or, you know, however you want to call this in GW17 or 17. So there was this first paper out of Northwestern, I think, claiming that there's actually rebrightening of the X-ray emission. And so you co-authored the other paper that was modeling and saying there's no rebrightening, but potentially a persistent source. Am I interpreting that correctly? Or
I don't know.
Essentially saying that if you introduce that additional sort of persistent source, whatever it may be, it actually might give you an improvement on sort of on taking all the data together with the centroid data. Mm-hmm. So in the end, are you saying there is actually something?
In the end, I am saying that there is no, this sentence on the bottom sort of sums it up. There's no robust evidence for a new source. The fit improves unambiguously. And this is sort of, I think we're the first group to fit, as far as I can tell, everything. We have the afterglow, we have the LIGO, posteriors are priors, and we're doing the radio centroid. We're really trying to take every photon and graviton that we can. And with all of this, the fit unambiguously improves if you allow there to be a new source there, a flat source, although we can't really constrain whether or not there'd be a slope there at all, but a new source of X-rays. But the improvement is marginal. It's only 2 sigma, which is not enough to claim discovery or anything like that. We're also, you know, this very last X-ray data point was only 5 counts. And so there's a lot of swing, you know, we're reading a lot into single digit numbers of photons here. The only thing we can really do is sort of wait to have a longer baseline. If this thing continues sort of fluttering at like 5 or 6 counts per 100 kiloseconds, then we'll know something for sure. But right now it's still too early to say.
Okay,
we'll blast through the summary. I have 10 minutes to talk a little bit about binary accretion. This is sort of some recent work that I've been doing with a grad student, Alex Dittman at UMD. And so I'm just gonna jump right into this. A nice picture from Star Trek. I really like this, the very first season of Star Trek Discovery, which is sort of the new season. They had this big battle around a binary star system, and there were disks and there was gas going between them, and it was very cool. And of course I care more about black hole accretion, so really it should be something like this. But it was nice to see this. This is sort of a dream simulation. The end goal in many years will be able to do something like this, where we have sort of disks. There have mutual inclinations. There's sort of a some sort of jet-like thing coming in from the one on the left. We have sort of dust and sort of gravitational instabilities to produce compact objects that are inside the disk, and doing all of this at the same time would be absolutely lovely, and it's completely beyond our abilities at the moment. Ultimately, it'd be great to be able to simulate something like this. But we'll stick with binary black holes. We all really like binary black holes. And a big question is, what happens when you have binary black holes with gas? There are some observational hints of what might happen. There's a famous quasar, PG1302, it's AGN in a distant galaxy, that has been varying, sort of modulated with a particular period for a while now. And there's some debate as to whether or not it's keeping this period or not. Its AGN are variable. And so actually determining whether or not there's sort of a sinusoidal variability to any AGN is very hard. You need a very long baseline of measurements. PG1302 is sort of the best candidate for sort of a long baseline sinusoidally varying AGN, which would be sort of easy to explain if there were a binary black hole at its center instead of a single. And then this is going to be or modulated at some sort of multiple of the binary orbital period. And we also have PTA systems looking at the sky, pulsar timing arrays. This is an old result. I need to update this plot. But this is sort of an old result from the NanoGrav, I think, collaboration. And as the pulsar timing array data set gets larger and larger, we're starting to see hints of gravitational wave signals in the pulsar timing arrays, and starting to be able to constrain early models of what we think the population of these sources may be. And so there's a big question. So for supermassive binary black holes, we know that every galaxy has a supermassive binary black hole at its center. We know galaxies merge. And so eventually these black holes should meet each other in their centers. We know that they can get close to each other because of gravitational scattering to within about a parsec. We know once they get very close together, gravitational waves will inspiral them to merger. And sort of the space between the parsec and the gravitational wave scale is still sort of questionable. Gravitational scattering can probably shrink you quite a bit if you have like a triaxial distribution of stars. But there's an open question as to whether or not gas will sort of help or hinder you in this process. And this can affect your predictions for things like pulsar timing arrays. If your black holes, if gas hinders the merger of the black holes, and you might have black holes staying in sort of at one frequency for a really long time that can make a big signal. If gas helps the shrinkage, then they might just sort of zip all the way down and merge really quickly. And so if you do a simulation, you get something like this. This is what the gas does. This is sort of a 2D viscous hydro simulation with a code called DISCO that I'm a developer on. It's been used to study binary bubble black hole accretion quite a bit. And as you can see, you get a very dynamic system. The black holes end up clearing out a cavity. This is assuming the black holes are accreting from a prograde aligned circumbinary disk. We have a large circumbinary disk, like a proper AGN disk, and then two sort of black holes in the middle instead of one. And what they do is they end up clearing out a cavity and accreting from the walls of this cavity. Each black hole gets their own mini disk. And we would really like to understand sort of how these gas dynamics affect the evolution of these systems. So we know the black holes are going to accrete mass and angular momentum from the surrounding gas. We know the circumbinary disk has a lot of angular momentum, so it's not crazy to think that the gas, that they would spin up the black holes and cause the binary to get larger. But there's also asymmetries here. There's all these streams in this elliptical cavity, and that can produce gravitational torques on the black holes, which maybe could pull them backwards and shrink their angular momentum and cause them to fall closer together. And so we really want to know, ultimately, does gas sort of shrink or expand the binary, help or hinder the process? And many people have been working on this for a number of years. And these systems are sort of very dynamic and can only really be hit with computers. I have not a lot of time left, so I'm going to quickly jump through. I use a code called DISCO. It's a very fancy moving mesh code, and I would love to talk to you more about it, but I will save that for afterwards. I'm just going to jump to the science part.
So it seems you also get this m equal one instability here, this m equal one arm in the accretion disk, in the circumbinary accretion disk.
So it is there's a lot of features that in these systems that sort of we know that we don't fully understand, but everyone sees and everyone agrees they should be there. So everyone agrees there should be a cavity. They agree the cavity is eccentric. So there's sort of one end of this cavity will be closer to the binary than the other. The cavity precesses. And there is a lump of material, an overdensity, that orbits around the cavity wall. At the local orbital speed. And precisely why this lump forms and precisely why the cavity becomes eccentric are still questions people are trying to work out. But these are sort of unambiguous things. Everyone sees them. GRMHD simulations doing the black holes and these Newtonian simulations doing very long time scales all see the same stuff.
Jeff, just a quick question. Is yours a Newtonian or a GR simulation?
This is a Newtonian. Everything I'm going to show you here is going to be Newtonian.
So your black holes are Paczynski-Vita black holes?
These black holes are, they are not Paczynski-Vita black holes. They are, they're sort of, they're just regular 1/r point masses with a softening parameter inside some radius to prevent, you know, dividing by zero in the simulation.
Okay, so but material that is accreted, does it affect the mass of the black? Are you changing the mass of the black hole, or this is just so irrelevant that you don't
do it? No, this is a very good question. So there's people do these simulations in many sort of different styles. The approach that we've been taking and that I'll be showing you here in the next 45 seconds or so is that is where we have fixed mass black holes on fixed orbits. So we do not update the mass of the black holes. We do not update the orbital parameters. They're just sort of stirring the gas. And the idea is to try to surround this by a gaseous disk and try to see and let it approach something like a steady state, some sort of quasi-steady state. And we want to see and measure the sort of the instantaneous or the time averaged torque on the binary. But you bring up a really good point. These are just a regular black hole would eat the gas and removes gas from the simulation. It gets compressed and added to the black hole. If you, in a Newtonian simulation, you have no procedure for doing this. So you have to just artificially go in and add in source terms that remove gas at some prescribed rate. And these are called sinks. And these sinks, it turns out, can have an effect on the simulation. Because the sinks have to remove gas, but they also need to remove momentum and energy if you're conserving energy. And how you do that will affect sort of the local structure of the gas and can sort of proceed outwards and affect the whole simulation. This problem is all boundary conditions. The volume and sort of simulating it is really easy. Prescribing the boundary conditions is really hard. And ultimately what we're trying to measure is something sort of about the boundary conditions. We want to know what is the overall rate of angular momentum accretion throughout the disk. And so you have to be really careful with these prescriptions. What we did here is, and so it turns out that one thing you have to do is you need, and this was sort of recently realized, that one thing one should do is make sure that the sinks that are removing these mass do not add or subtract any torque to the gas. The what we're trying to model with these sink particles is a disk that sort of continues all the way down to the ISCO and then then plunges into the event horizon. And that gas has lost almost all of its angular momentum by the time it reaches the ISCO, and compared with like the orbital angular momentum it has at large distances. And so when you subtract gas, you shouldn't be subtracting angular momentum. You should subtract very, very little. So what we've done here is we sort of improved sort of the sink prescription to do this properly. And what this ends up doing for you is this ends up giving you mini disks that are sort of independent of with sort of a mass profile that is independent of the sort of the rate at which you subtract away gas, which is really nice. This is sort of on the right hand side here. You can see the single disk profiles with these sinks, and on the right hand side with these torque free sinks. There's a lot of curves here. But you can believe me that sort of outside the gravitational radius, everything sort of lines up real nicely, despite them all having different sink rates. And this is because we aren't removing angular momentum, so you can find its natural sort of analytic profile. We simulate these things for so we did a study of this, sort of taking these sinks and seeing how they affect binary, the circumbinary evolution. You just simulate them for a long time. This is the accretion rate through the black holes. And so you need to simulate them for about 2000 orbits, which is quite a long time. We did it for a whole bunch of mass ratios. On the left, we have an equal mass binary. On the right, we have a 1 to 10 mass ratio. The upper panel is showing you the surface density of the gas, and the bottom panel is showing you the gravitational torque on each one. And you can see there's differences. They can be hard to quantify, but sort of it's a very rich problem with lots of free parameters. And what we found was here we have the top panel here is d log a over d log m. This is the change in binary semi-major axis So the change in the size of the binary per unit mass accreted. And the blue symbols are when we use sort of the standard sync prescription that that essentially everyone uses, which is not torque free, which sort of removes mass with its local momentum. And if you're careful to not remove, to not apply any torque through this procedure, our torque free syncs gives you the orange crosses, which at low mass ratio are give you substantially different evolutions. And these are all positive. The binary symmetry major axis increases with per unit mass. And so these are all sort of binaries that are expanding. And the sinks are particularly important at low mass ratio. You might think that this Q equals 0.2 binary would stall at like zero. But actually, when you do the sinks right, you get that it the binary expands quite nicely. So in this case, and these are all sort of with a scale height of 0.1 Mach 10 disks. And also binaries evolve towards equal mass. The low mass ratio disks, the secondary accretes preferentially. And so the mass ratio will tend to increase towards one, which is the result that people have known for a while. Nice confirmation. I'm a few minutes past time. I have three or four more slides. I can keep going or we can pause here.
So may I ask a question here?
Of course.
So this is a 2D simulation, right?
This is 2D, yeah, vertically
integrated. How would you expect the result to change if you, let's say, do 3D for a similar system?
People have done 3D simulations with this. A lot of them have been SPH, sort of at the Newtonian large scale range. And people have also done 3D simulations sort of at very close, with very close binaries doing full GRMHD. And sort of broadly speaking, the results are similar. These disks, especially sort of the disks in our upcoming paper are very thin. And just adding 3D, I don't think will change too much. It might change sort of the overall magnitude of these things a little bit, but I wouldn't expect the trends to be affected too much.
Because for 2D, you need to introduce this sync effectively, but for 3D, you don't need that, right? Like,
3D, you would still need a sync, assuming you're doing one of these Newtonian simulations. If you're doing 3D with two black holes on the grid and you're properly doing relativity, then you wouldn't need sinks, and then that would be excellent. The bigger change going to 3D is if you're going to 3D, then you can also do MHD, and instead of doing this sort of constant viscosity using to transport angular momentum, you can have proper MRI, and that I do not know how that would affect the results. People have done the GRMHD results with MRI, and they have sort of qualitatively similar disks and things, but how that would affect the torques on long time scales, I don't know.
Yeah, well, your result suggests that the binary would expand at all time and instead of shrink. So for this kind of system embedded in disk, you're suggesting they will never merge then, as long as the disk is there.
They will never merge so long as the disk is there. Assuming the disk behaves like one of these disks, as long as the disk is there, as long as the disk is prograde, so orbiting with in the same direction as the binary, and assuming the disk is sufficiently thick. So this was all for H over R of 0.1, so Mach 10 disks, which is hotter than we would expect AGN disks to be. AGN disks are typically cooler with a Mach numbers of about 100, so H over R of 0.01. And those disks actually, this is the next section, but they're the torque switches sign. And those binaries actually shrink.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. I have another question regarding 2D and 3D.
Yeah.
In cataclysmic variables, 3D actually does look different because you have an accretion stream hitting the side of a disk. In your case, the smaller disks, And that accretion stream can then, I don't know the English word, an overstream, when it kind of expands out, you have the disk and part of the gas gets over the disk and hits the disk at another side. And that changes the light curves. And I don't know whether it would be important in your case, but it could change, I guess, the structure of the small disks. I don't know whether the effect occurs, of course.
Yeah, that certainly could affect the structure of the smaller disks, because these streams are sort of constantly interacting. A lot of the torque, especially for the colder, more realistic disks, appears to be controlled by sort of the shape and density of the streams themselves, not the mini, not less so the mini disks. My general expectation, I believe a lot of this problem is controlled more by just the sort of the orbital mechanics than sort of the detail, than a lot of the details of sort of the of how you treat the gas. Which does say that the how you treat the gas is completely unimportant. For instance, when you change the Mach number, you change the sign of the torque, which is a pretty big effect. But as the disks get colder and more realistic, you're sort of approaching more of this sort of ballistic cold regime where orbital mechanics, I think, would be more of more of the dominant effect than sort of small details of where the gas hits. But I could be wrong. It would be great to, right now, we don't have the capability of running one of these things in 3D for as long as we need to get a steady state. So once we do, that would be, I would really like to see what that would look like.
So Jeff, it seems like for the thin disks, thin AGN disks, you're essentially saying that there's per se no problem with the final parsec problem. Essentially reformulating your statement, but
yeah,
it would be one for thick disks. So is this gonna be problematic?
I can show you the result. The thick disks, the AGN we see tend to be quite thin. Thinner than we can than is easy to simulate. So here, this is the sort of the same d log a over d log m. This is the how the binary separation changes with accreted mass. The orange is stuff that expands, and the green is stuff that shrinks. And the cold disks shrink it quite a bit, actually. We're a little surprised how strong this negative power is. The realistic disks are sort of all in this green corner, we think. Depends a little bit on what you think the viscosity might be. The other thing to remember is that everything we're doing here is disks that are coplanar with the binary and prograde. If you think that a binary is sitting in the center of a galaxy and being fed gas from more or less all directions somewhat chaotically, you know, as clouds come in and fall and get disrupted, then it might half the time roughly be accreting from gas with the same sign as the angular momentum, and the other half would be accreting with gas that's retrograde. When prograde disks have this very interesting balance where the gas has a lot more angular momentum sort of per unit mass than the black hole, but it needs to lose that angular momentum in order to get down to the black hole and accrete. So there's this really detailed balance to try to figure out whether or not the black hole sort of gains or loses angular momentum. In the retrograde case, you don't have that same problem. The gas comes in with the opposite sign of the angular momentum from the black hole, and presumably would shrink it quite rapidly. So if you think about a binary that's accreting over many cycles, it has some sort of duty cycle, then I think you'd expect it to the gas would shrink it on average.
Luis has his hands up.
Yeah, so it's related back to the dimension. So, I mean, turbulence plays a highly non-trivial role here to determine your viscosity.
Totally.
But turbulence in 2D behaves very different from turbulence in 3D.
Yep.
So it seems that there is a very significant component that may be completely off, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. You would need to, so we don't have, our accretion here is done our angular momentum transport is done completely via just Navier-Stokes viscosity with a constant kinematic viscosity. In fact, it's not even an alpha prescription. So our idea with these problems is to sort of try to set up a clean problem that's easy to simulate, where we can sort of get a sort of a clean mathematical answer, hopefully, and have some hope of maybe even trying to get some analytic control over it eventually. Ultimately, for realistic scenarios, you would want to do 3D, you'd want to have proper turbulence, proper viscosity. And I suspect those situations would sort of map onto these without too much difficulty. But that is a complete guess. I don't and really needs to be checked. You're muted, Louis.
Yeah. So here in particular, I'm worried about where energy goes in the material of the disk as far as a direct cascade or an inverse cascade. Mm-hmm. And yeah, in people doing astrophysical simulations are very fond of different types of kind of effective viscosities. And I have no idea how do they know things are correct. This alpha viscosity, a whole bunch of names that they're there because that's what can be done, not necessarily that we know it's is correct.
Yep, absolutely. And this is the big caveat on all of this work and the work and all the, and most of the work that's been done in this problem on secular timescales. The hope is that this is most again is that sort of is that the visco- is that the details of the angular momentum transport hopefully aren't too important, that they mainly serve to sort of bring gas close to the binary, and then it's mainly orbital mechanics that sort of do the details. Whether or not that's true, though, should be checked. I would love to check it. It would take some time.
Also, there's like the issue of winds, right? Like these disks also drive winds, and that's also an important ingredient in the overall angular momentum transport. And so that definitely affects on top of what actually your viscosity is, or what you know your physical reason for viscosity is, also affects all the angular momentum transport of the system. So,
mm-hmm. Yep, that is very true. I didn't have we can this is here. I'll do there we go.
Excellent. Yeah. Okay. Any final questions or thoughts? Anyone?
Just a comment. Just to rebalance, if you start with a Star Trek picture, you should end with a Star Wars picture.
Oh, good point. Good point. Next time.
I had one other question. First of all, thanks for the nice talk, Jeff. But just to kind of pile on a little more about the 2D versus 3D, I was just a little bit confused, even just like a very naive question about what you're assuming to make a 2D problem, right? Because you're not quite assuming a translational symmetry and direction orthogonal to the equator, right? You're saying it's a you're integrating over that dimension or something like that? So could you say exactly kind of what you're assuming about the dimension you're not including in your simulation domain?
Right, so we are doing, so these, we're treating this problem sort of the formal term is vertically integrated. So you take your Euler or your Navier-Stokes equations, integrate in Z, and throw away the complicated terms. And what you end up getting is essentially the 2D Navier-Stokes equations, where you have sort of surface density instead of so grams per centimeter squared instead of sort of a 3D density grams per centimeter cubed. You're implicitly assuming the gas sort of moves in columns, so you assume there's no vertical gradients in the translational velocity. We assume the vertical velocity is zero, so there's no real true expansion vertically. We're assuming the disk is isothermal with a particular sound speed that is proportional to the local gravitational potential. And so we assume that sort of as the gas sort of radiates away, you know, whatever heat it would build up due to viscosity and things. And this gives us a disk that has constant aspect ratio. So H over R is fixed. For an isothermal disk, these are, if you think the isothermality is an okay assumption, then the vertical integration isn't too bad. If you want to conserve energy properly and have like a proper cooling function, then you need to start worrying about sort of departures from vertical hydrostatic equilibrium. And you can start having sort of breathing modes and things. And that gets a lot more complicated than what we're doing here. Here we're doing pretty much the simplest thing you can do.
Hey guys, sorry, just to make sure I understand. So it's almost like a translational symmetry for the fluid, but then it's not quite like that. And as I get a little confused when you said there, you threw away the complicated terms.
So there's a, if you integrate over, for instance, the sort of the momentum flux that's like density and then two velocities, rho vv. You integrate over that vertically, you can imagine sort of expanding all of your, expanding each of your grid functions in a power series in z in the vertical direction. So each of them have a constant component, and then they have quotients that are linear in the height, and then quotients that are quadratic in the height and above the disk and so on, in like your real 3D disk. And then the integration is trivial for the zeroth order terms, because they don't depend on height at all. You just multiply by the height and away you go. And then there's sort of mixture terms that are complicated that we ignore. So we just only take the leading order terms in height. And this is sort of it's not really necessarily a defense of this, but this is what everyone does when they do sort of these 2D vertically integrated disks, just about. It's on my list of things to do in the near future is actually sort of improve on this. There's been some really good work recently. Gordon Ogilvie has developed a really nice model for how to sort of treat some of these departures from just sort of pure coplanar stuff. And so getting those into disco is very high on my to-do list.
Okay, yeah, thank you.
Okay, any final comments or questions? Okay, well, if not, let's thank Jeff again for a really great talk. You kept us going for almost 1.5 hours. That's great. And people like the talk, it seems. See some nice statements on the chat. So thanks a lot, Jeff.
Thank you.
See you all next week.